Hello, this is Christopher Bolin again. It's November 9th, Friday afternoon. I'm glad to be with you. This is our third program on Bolin.com. And I want to, I've been very busy working on the second chapter of Solving 9/11. And some people have written to me and said, you know, you should put this stuff together in a book. And I thought about that, and I thought about compiling my articles into a book. But recently, or since August or so, I've become very, since I've been able to get away from the travails of Cook County, I've been able to dedicate a lot of time and research to 9/11. And I found out some, you know, I've been able to pursue the loose ends. And what I've decided to do is put this book together in the form of Solving 9/11. Now, as a journalist and a historian, this has to be done. Particularly as a historian, there has to be, in the historiography, there has to be the dissenting view. There is the media view of 9/11, which is not proven, which is not based on any facts, but is pushed on the American people by and the world by the media. 9/11 is, however, a crime of such magnitude, and it is so important because it is the seminal event. It is the genesis of this rotten zeitgeist that's been imposed on the United States and the world called the War on Terror. It is the midwife of two illegal wars in the Middle East and more coming, I'm sure. And for that reason, for our posterity and for history, we have to bring out the facts and the truth about 9/11. And I'm going to read now the beginning of this chapter 2. And it's not finished yet. And one person has written and asked, well, you know, when is this article coming? And I'm not working on a deadline. I'm doing research every day. I'd like to have this article done now as well. But I find so many things. My research takes me into so many different directions and avenues. Putting it into, you know, getting an article done every week like I used to do for my newspaper job isn't so simple. These articles are research articles, and I'm not simply repeating material that I've already covered. I'm plowing new material. I'm finding new things. So I'm going to read the beginning of this article. This is chapter 2, and it's entitled, the working title is Israeli False Flag Terror Attacks Against the United States Prior to 9/11. As I've said in the introduction, the first article in the Solving 9/11 series, The Planes of 9/11, explains that the Israeli military has a long history of owning and operating private aircraft leasing and maintenance companies in the United States. These privately held aviation companies, controlled by the Israeli military and linked to its state-owned avionics aviation industry, had the capability and advanced avionics required to convert Boeing aircraft into remote-controlled guided missiles, like those that apparently struck the World Trade Center on 9/11. The Israeli military had the capability and means to carry out the attacks. So the question of Israeli involvement in 9/11 raises a question that must be asked. Would the Israeli military conduct such an outrageous act of terror against the United States? While millions of Americans accept blindly, without any proof whatsoever, the controlled media version that 19 Arabs were completely responsible for the carnage and destruction of 9/11, very few are willing to even look at the evidence of Israeli involvement in crimes of 9/11, in the crimes of 9/11. Although the evidence clearly points to Israeli involvement, the widespread misconceptions about Zionist history and ignorance of previous Israeli crimes and terrorism prevent most people from comprehending the obvious. In order to understand 9/11, it is essential to have a grasp of the history of previous Israeli attacks on the United States. This article examines a few little-known but key events in the history of Israeli false flag terror attacks against the United States and the Zionist planners behind them. False flag means an act of terror planned and perpetrated by one party for the purpose of having the blame assigned to its enemy for political or strategic purposes. 9/11, like many other major terror attacks, as well as those which have plagued occupied Iraq for years, are textbook false flag operations. False flag attacks are designed to foment hostility between groups or sects, or to instigate war. Only very rarely has the United States, oceans away from the conflicts of Europe and Asia, actually been attacked by foreign militaries. The British invasion of 1812 and the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor in 1941 are the only two foreign attacks prior to the terror attacks of 9/11 that come to mind. Although disguised and interpreted by the government and media as an act of Arab terrorism, the evidence strongly suggests that 9/11 was a carefully planned false flag terror attack carried out by the Israeli military after years of planning and preparation. This is not a thesis that can simply be dismissed as based on speculation or prejudice. There is solid evidence that indicates that Israeli intelligence had prior knowledge of 9/11 and was involved in the planning and execution of the attacks. The public statements made by the jubilant Israeli movers, who were actually Israeli intelligence agents, for example, are clearly indicative of prior knowledge. In November 2001, after being released from 2 months in U.S. custody, three of the five agents appeared on Israeli television and admitted that their purpose had been to document the event. The Israeli interviewer did not ask the men who had sent them to document the events of 9/11, but it is quite clear they were working for an agency of the State of Israel. The five fake movers from Urban Moving Systems of Weehawken, New Jersey, were operatives from the Israeli Secret Services. The five Israeli agents, described in early news reports as Middle Eastern men, had been sought on 9/11 by the FBI and New Jersey authorities after they had been observed celebrating and photographing the destruction of the World Trade Center. They had even gone so far as to pose, flicking their cigarette lighters, laughing and cheering as hundreds of innocent people were being roasted alive in the burning towers behind them. There are reports that they had worn Palestinian or Arab clothing, which was found in their van. Two of the five Israelis who were caught with multiple passports, box cutters, thousands of dollars stuffed into their socks, and driving a van that tested positive for explosives were actually on a list of foreign agents known to U.S. law enforcement authorities. Evidently, the five movers were intelligence operatives of an Israeli terror cell operating in New York City. The Urban Moving Systems Company was later exposed as a Mossad front company set up to facilitate Israeli covert operations in New York City. An American who worked with the company said that the Israeli employees had openly rejoiced over the events of 9/11. The instant messages warning of the precise minute of the attack at the World Trade Center, sent via the Mossad-owned Odigo messaging system, sent several hours prior to the first plane hitting the North Tower, are further evidence that members of Israeli intelligence agencies had very specific and accurate knowledge of the terror attacks long before they occurred. In a complex and elaborately planned crime of mass murder and terrorism like 9/11, the possession of specific prior knowledge like that known to the fake Israeli movers and the senders of the Odigo messages is evidence of involvement in the crime. Had the recipients of the Odigo messages, the warnings, contacted the responsible authorities in New York, thousands of lives would have been saved. Taking into consideration the evidence that Israeli intelligence agents had prior knowledge of 9/11, with the knowledge that the Israeli military had the capability to launch such sophisticated false flag terror attack, the obvious question has to be asked, would Israeli military agencies commit such an atrocious act of terrorism in the United States in order to achieve a strategic goal? The question whether elements of the Israeli military would conduct a false flag terror attack against the United States, their main ally, in order to fix the blame on the Arabs, their enemies, raises several specific questions. 1. Has the Israeli military conducted false flag terror attacks against the United States in the past? 2. If so, are there links between the people or agencies involved in the previous terror attacks and 9/11? 3. Is there a strategic goal for which Zionist planners would conduct such an extremely dangerous, outrageous, and sophisticated terrorist operation? If so, has that strategic goal been realized as a result of 9/11? Yes, is the answer to all four questions. The Israeli military has a documented history of attacking U.S. targets and conducting false flag terror attacks. Zionist extremists are, in fact, the prime suspects with the strongest motive for having carried out 9/11. The Zionist motive for staging a new Pearl Harbor was to kickstart their long-planned war on terror. On the other hand, there is no Arab motive to attack the World Trade Center or Pentagon. Why would Arabs or Muslims commit such a counterproductive act in the first place? Why would any Arab invite an American military invasion of their nation or any other Arab nation? The Arab terror scenario simply makes no sense. On the other hand, senior officials of the Mossad and Israel's military intelligence, an organization known as Aman, have a history of carrying out false flag terror attacks against the United States at least as far back as the Lavon Affair of the early 1950s, during which Israeli agents bombed U.S. and British libraries, theaters, and other government institutions in Egypt in a botched false flag terror campaign designed to have the blame put on Egyptian groups. In June 1967, 13 years after the Lavon Affair, the Israeli Air Force and Navy deliberately strafed, bombed, napalmed, and torpedoed an unarmed U.S. vessel, the USS Liberty, and tried to kill all of the nearly 300 crew members simply to achieve a strategic wartime goal. Recently released documents from the National Security Agency confirm that the United States government at the time had evidence that the Israelis had deliberately attacked the USS Liberty, knowing it was a U.S. vessel. The U.S. government, military, and media all went along with the government with the cover-up to avoid blaming Israel for the murder of 34 American servicemen and the wounding of 173 others. Now, the Zionist fraud known as the War on Terror, with its pre-planned U.S.-led invasions and occupations of Afghanistan and Iraq, is, in fact, the realization of an important strategic goal for Israeli military planners. To have the armies of the United States and European nations occupying Iraq, the most powerful and advanced Arab nation, has always been the dream of Zionist strategic planners. Although it is never mentioned as such in the U.S. media, it needs to be understood that the war on terror, with its invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, constitutes a war of aggression. To prepare for and carry out a war of aggression is the most serious war crime. It is a crime against peace under the Nuremberg Principles of 1950, written by USA. The United States and its allies convicted and strangled to death dozens of senior Nazis at the Nuremberg trials for having committed precisely such war crimes. Prior to invading Afghanistan in the aftermath of 9/11, the U.S. government failed to prove that the terror attacks had been planned, sponsored, or executed by members of the ruling Taliban regime. 6 years after invading Afghanistan, the U.S. government still has not proven that any link exists between the Taliban regime and 9/11. Nor is there any evidence of involvement by any member of the regime of the former Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. Furthermore, the charges that the Iraqi regime had obtained weapons of mass destruction, trumpeted by senior officials of the Bush administration and Judith Miller of the New York Times, turned out to have been completely baseless lies crafted solely for the purpose of deceiving the public and provoking an illegal invasion. The passage of time does not make a war of aggression and occupation any less illegal. There are key people involved in the 1954 Israeli terror bombings of the U.S. Information Agency libraries in Alexandria and Cairo who held high-level positions in the Israeli government of 2001. And there are other Israelis with long histories of terrorism and strategic planning who have revealed that they had a very specific prior knowledge of 9/11 long before 2001. The highest Israeli intelligence official at the time of the Lavon Affair, Yisr Harel, evidently was well aware of the long-term planning of 9/11 more than 20 years before it happened. Decades of planning. In 1980, 21 years before September 11th, Yisr Harel, the first director of both the Shin Bet and the Mossad, predicted with uncanny accuracy the events of 9/11 to Michael D. Evans, an American supporter of Zionist extremists of the Jabotinsky sort. On September 23, 1980, Evans visited Harel at his home in Israel and had dinner with him and Dr. Reuven Hecht, a senior advisor to then Prime Minister Menachem Begin. In an editorial entitled America the Target, published in the Jerusalem Post of September 30, 2001, Evans related what Harel had told him. This is quoted material now. This is Evans speaking. I sat with former Mossad chief Yisr Harel for a conversation about Arab terrorism. As he handed me a cup of hot tea and a plate of cookies, I asked him, "Do you think terrorism will come to America? And if so, where and why?" Harel looked at his American visitor, Evans, and replied, "I fear it will come to you in America. America has the power, but not the will to fight terrorism. The terrorists have the will, but not the power to fight America. But all that could change with time. Arab oil money buys more than tents." As to the where, Harel continued, "New York City is the symbol of freedom and capitalism. It's likely they will strike the Empire State Building, your tallest building," he mistakenly thought, "and a symbol of your power." Now, in another article by Mr. Evans entitled "Jimmy Carter, Radical Islam's Ally," he repeated and related the same story about Harel with a few different words, but the same idea. He wrote, "My last question to Harel was, would terrorism ever come to America? Harel said, 'You have the power to fight it,' he said, 'but not the will. They have the will, but not the power. All of that will change in time. Yes, I fear it will come to New York and your tallest building, which is a symbol of your fertility.'" Now think about this for a minute. The founder and anchor of Israeli intelligence tells an American supporter in 1980 that Arab terrorists will strike the tallest building in New York City in the future. His prediction comes true in 1993 with the hapless and thoroughly fake attack designed and carried out by the FBI, which is then followed 8 years later by an extremely well-planned and lethal attack which kills thousands. Now, who is Yisr Harel? Under David Ben-Gurion, the first leader of the Haganah and the new Israeli state, Yisr Harel was the former chief of Haganah intelligence from 1944, the Shin Bet from 1948, and the Mossad until 1963. Given his unique position and penchant for terrorism as a means of coercion, the uncanny accuracy of Harel's prediction says much more about the years of Israeli planning that went into 9/11 than it does about any alleged criminal plots of Arab origin. After nearly two decades as the head of Israeli intelligence, Ben-Gurion reportedly asked Harel to resign in 1963 because of Harel's use of terrorism bombings as a means of coercion. Harel, as director of the Mossad, had initiated the Damocles operation, which was a terror bombing campaign against German scientists in an Israeli attempt to keep German technology from reaching Egypt, which was developing its defense systems at the time. Two of Harel's Mossad agents had been arrested and jailed in Switzerland for using terror bombs against German scientists. The wife of one scientist was killed in a mysterious explosion, a second scientist disappeared, and the secretary of a third scientist was blinded and mutilated by a mail bomb in Cairo. It's interesting to note that the Jerusalem Post published an editorial written by Yosef Goel entitled "Yisr Harel and the German Scientists" on February 22, 1991, in which a thinly veiled threat was delivered to modern-day European scientists and companies who do business with Arab nations. This is what Yosef Goel wrote. "The directors and managers of those firms and the experts who work for them should be reminded that they are playing with their lives and the welfare of their families. It would be well if they went back and studied the episode of Yisr Harel and the German scientists in Nasser's missile program of the 1960s. That's the end of that quote. I would say that Americans should go back and and would be very well advised to study the Israeli involvement in the terror bombings against American targets in the Lavon Affair in 1954. That's the title of the next section here, The Lavon Affair. The Lavon Affair, or the Shameful Affair in Hebrew, called Esek Habish, as it is known in Hebrew, was an early Israeli false flag terror campaign against the United States and Britain that was carried out in Egypt in 1954. Israeli military intelligence had set up a terror cell of sleeper agents in Egypt, which was activated in July 1954 to blow up U.S. and British targets. The Israeli operation was codenamed Susanna. The false flag terrorist bombings were meant to be blamed on Egyptians in order to alienate the U.S. and Britain from President Gamal Abdel Nasser and prevent Egypt from nationalizing the Suez Canal. The Lavon Affair is very seldom discussed in the media or in university courses on Middle Eastern history. Strict censorship in the Israeli media has prevented the Israeli public from knowing about the affair for many years. Only in 2005, 51 years after the bombings, did Israel finally admit responsibility for its 1954 false flag terrorist bombing campaign in Egypt. The false flag terror bombings were carried out between July 2nd and July 27, 1954, by a covert terror cell composed of about one dozen Egyptian Jews under the command of Israeli intelligence agents. The Israeli-run terror cell was discovered and broken up on July 27, 1954, when one of its members was caught after the bomb he was carrying in his pocket, I read, exploded in Alexandria. A top-secret Israeli terrorist cell, Unit 131, was reportedly responsible for the terror bombings. At the time of the terror bombings, Unit 131 is said to have been the subject of a dispute between Amman and Mossad over who controlled it. Unit 131 operatives had been recruited several years before when the Israeli intelligence officer Avram Dar, who arrived in Cairo as an Israeli undercover agent posing as a British citizen from Gibraltar named John Darling. Dar recruited Egyptian Jews who had previously been active in illegal immigration to Israel and trained them for covert operations in Egypt. The Israeli terror cell went to work in the summer of 1954. On July 2nd, a post office in Alexandria was firebombed. On July 14th, the U.S. Information Agency libraries in Alexandria and Cairo and a British theater were bombed. The bombs contained nitroglycerin had been put on the shelves of the libraries. After the terrorist cell was discovered, three of the Israeli terrorist commanders succeeded in fleeing Egypt, and a fourth committed suicide. After the trial in Cairo, two of the accused Egyptian Jews were condemned to death and executed, and eight were condemned to long terms of imprisonment. Although the consequences of the Lavon Affair for Israel were huge, the Israeli prime minister and foreign minister at the time, Moshe Sheret, was evidently unaware of the intrigue, which had apparently been carried out by disciples of David Ben-Gurion, namely Isser Harel, Moshe Dayan, and Shimon Peres. Moshe Sheret, born Shertok in Kherson, Ukraine, was Israel's first foreign minister from 1948 until 1956 and second prime minister from 1953 until 1955. Sheret held both key positions at the time of the covert Israeli terror bombings in Egypt, but was unaware of the plot. Sheret, who appears in history to have been completely, to know nothing about the terror ring, was only informed of the facts afterwards. In October 1953, shortly before Ben-Gurion took a two-year hiatus in the Negev desert, he had appointed Pinhas Lavon, a staunch supporter of retaliation, that is, terrorism policy, as Minister of Defense, and nominated Moshe Dayan as the Armed Forces Chief of Staff. When Sheret was told of Ben-Gurion's decision to nominate Dayan as Chief of Staff, he wrote this note in his diary: "The new Chief of Staff's immense capacity for plotting and intrigue-making will yield many complications." Pinhas Lavon, the Israeli Minister of Defense at the time of the terror bombings in Egypt, was part of a group of military leaders who advocated the use of terrorism against the Western nations, particularly Britain and the United States. This group included the Polish-born immigrants David Ben-Gurion and Shimon Peres, who was born Shimon Pershki, and Moshe Dayan, the kibbutznik son of Ukrainian immigrants. When the Israeli terror plot was exposed, Ben-Gurion blamed Lavon, who was a competitor with him, who in turn blamed Colonel Benjamin Givli, the Ben-Gurion protege and the head of Amman, the military intelligence. Lavon said that Givli had organized the covert operation behind his back. Yet Prime Minister Moshe Sheret had no doubts about the guilt of the Dayan Peres Givli clique, according to the late Israeli historian Livia Rokach. For him, for Sheret, the question, this is her quoted material, the question of who gave the order was secondary to the necessity of pronouncing a judgment on the ideology and politics of Israel's terrorism. Therefore, while he had no doubt about the guilt of the Dayan Peres Givli clique, to him, Lavon's political responsibility was also inescapable. As Sheret wrote about Lavon in 1955, January, people ask me if I'm convinced that he gave the order. But let us assume that Givli has acted without instructions. Doesn't the moral responsibility lie all the same on Lavon, who has constantly preached for years acts of madness and taught the army leadership the diabolic lesson of how to set the Middle East on fire, how to cause friction, cause bloody confrontations, sabotage targets and property of the powers, acts of despair and suicide. As a moderate Zionist, Sheret believed that Israel's survival would be impossible without the support of the West. And interests in the Middle East would not, that the Western morality and interests in the Middle East would not support a Jewish state which behaves according to the laws of the jungle and raises terrorism to the level of a sacred principle. But Sheret's terrorist and violence-prone adversaries like Shimon Peres proved him wrong and dealt a crushing blow to the very hypothesis of moderate Zionism. In the final analysis, the West, and particularly the United States, let itself be frightened or blackmailed into supporting Israel's megalomaniac ambitions because an objective relationship of complicity already existed, and because once pushed into the open, this complicity proved capable of serving the cause of Western power politics in the region. The Western drug and oil cartels profiting from the opium of occupied Afghanistan and the oil of occupied Iraq illustrate Rokach's point that Israeli false flag terror is capable of serving the cause of Western power politics in the region. Now, I'll stop there. This is that's the beginning of the article that I'm working on. It's the second chapter of Solving 911, and that's about the first third or so. It's going to be about a 6,000-word article, and it should be done in the coming days. I would say two or three days to be ready. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to prepare it in a PDF format with photographs and the complete article, and I will send the PDF article to my supporters, people who have supported me in the past, people who have made donations via PayPal or have sent me, checks or something. If you're interested in this material about the Israeli false flag terror attacks and the evidence that of Israeli involvement in 911, particularly of the people like Yisr Harel having, advanced knowledge 20 years before, then you can write to me through my website, www.bolin.com. And if you go to About Bolin, they can send a donation, hell yeah?
Yes. And they can send you an email at feedback@bolin.com.
And how can they make a donation? How can they make a donation in order to get this
material? Well, they go to your website, and then they see where the donation button is.
Mm-hmm. And it's under About Bolin or something?
No, it's on the front page,
on the
index page.
And to those people who send a donation or those who have donated, I'll send a PDF file of this article.
Together with photographs?
Yes, the PDF file. There will be photographs in there, some important photographs. And the purpose of this article is to introduce Americans or to educate Americans into the history of Israeli false flag terror attacks against the United States in the past. So they can better understand the context, the historical context of what happened on September 11th. So I thank you for your time. And if you're interested in that, send me an email or go to my website and send a donation and request that you get a copy of this second chapter of Solving 911.
And we thank all the supporters for your letters and donations. And we hope that you will write more email to us.
I've had some very my supporters since in the last year, since the attack in Chicago and since I lost my job at American Free Press, I have been forced to change my way of working. And I have been in direct contact with people who have read my material in the past. And it's incredible because these people are absolutely incredible. They're some of them are extremely generous. They have been the saving grace. They have been what has kept me alive, out of jail, and able to continue doing my research. And without my supporters, I wouldn't be able to do this. Without support from listeners and readers, I wouldn't be able to dedicate the time that is required. I mean, I spend 8 hours a day, every day except Sunday, researching. And you know, I wake up in the middle of the night after I've had some good sleep, and these thoughts start sorting out, and I come across, you know, really important revelations in the middle of the night. And then I just, it's because I constantly am working on this Solving 911. And this will be a book. The first chapter was the Plains of 911. The second chapter is the chapter that I've read the first part of today. And this will be the book. And it's taking time, and I'm discovering a lot of new material. So if you're interested in this material, go to bolin.com and read about it, and you can send a donation, and I will send you the PDF of this chapter as soon as it's done, and that will be in just a few days. So thank you very much for today.
Thank you,
Helia. Mm-hmm. And I look forward to doing this again, especially when the book is done and I'm able to finish the chapter, because these audio files give people a chance to listen to this material when they're driving or when they're not able to read it. So thank you very much, and
we wish you all the best until our next radio program.
Right. And for updates, go to bolin.com, and you can read some of the letters from some of my supporters that have been most gracious and helpful. So thank you very much, and until next time, God bless.
Bye-bye.
In the event of something happening to me, there is something I would like you all to see. It's just a photograph of someone that I knew. Have you seen my wife, Mr. Jones? Do you know what it's like on the outside? Don't go talking too loud, you'll cause a landslide, Mr. Jones. I keep straining my ears to hear a sound. Maybe someone is digging underground. Or have they given up and all gone home to bed, thinking those who once existed must be dead? Have you seen my wife, Mr. Jones? Do you know what it's like on the outside? Don't go talking too loud, you'll cause a landslide, Mr. Jones. In the event of something happening to me, there is something I would like you all to see. It's just a photograph of someone that I knew. Have you seen?